Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel Jim Haley on behalf of Michael Jones. Your Honors, it's our contention that the Superior Court abused its discretion in not holding a Rule 61 hearing on Jones's motion and in other respects. If I might assume that the court is familiar with the procedural history a bit and the facts, I'll turn to the matters that I raised in my opening brief. There are matters, I'll concede at the outset, that perhaps they're inartfully pled, as Mr. Rafferty has replied, but if I can go through them in order, Your Honors. The first matter that Jones raised below is that the arrest warrant by Detective Cunningham reflects certain incredible facts, and that those matters were not properly raised in the trial court. I would submit, and this may be some tacking, I guess, perhaps, from the opening brief, that it was ineffective assistance for Jones's trial counsel to not raise those matters more effectively in the trial court.
Could you tell me briefly what difference it would have made? I understand your argument to be that the supposed statement that was given by the person who was in the hospital at the time the statement was given, the records indicate he was intubated, therefore he couldn't talk.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's something wrong about the statement of what was said. Either the date may be wrong or the statement was not as complete as it's described because he just nodded and, you know, made nonverbal motions in response to questions. But in the end, what difference does it make?
Yes, Your Honor. I acknowledge that the warrant itself may have been a nullity, as Mr. Rafferty replies in his answering brief, but that particular point Jones has insisted upon, that counsel did not effectively use in cross-examining Detective Cunningham, who was the chief investigating officer who gave the affidavit to the effect of that the victim identified Mr. Jones at the ER within 24 hours of the event, and there was no effective use of that, we contend, defective information against Detective Cunningham during the trial of this matter. So I acknowledge that the argument of Jones below that the defective warrant sort of invalidates the case or the arrest is not appropriate, but it's our submission that on an ineffective assistance of counsel approach, the credibility issues, Your Honor, raised by that warrant, the statement that Jones finds incredible about the identification that could have been attacked directly against a police officer or by bringing in other hospital witnesses, as he did raise in his ineffective assistance of counsel motion, namely nurses, doctors, et cetera, who would have testified, Jones believes, to the effect that that man could not have spoken in that condition, in that shape, on that date, that failure to attack that early identification, Your Honor, could have reasonably raised credibility and some doubt, some reasonable doubt perhaps in the jury's mind about the whole credibility of the state's case that might have changed the outcome, Your Honor. So that I would submit that's the basis on which to reflect that information, Your Honor.
What was the other evidence in the case that identified Jones as a shooter?
Well, Your Honor, the witnesses came forward at trial, and as I understand it, I was not the trial counsel myself. There was a witness named Kim Still, who was a girlfriend of the other co-defendant, namely Mr. Page, and that admissions were made to this Kim Still after the fact that she testified about at trial, and in some ways corroborated, I guess, that Mr. Jones was involved in this event.
Was there any other evidence that Mr. Jones was involved?
Not as I understand it directly, Your Honor. Not that I'm aware of. No, Your Honor. There was no eyewitness, as I understand it, but for Muhammad Renford, who was an attack against three persons, I think, and he was the only one who survived to identify his attacker.
Well, did he identify Jones at trial?
I understand. Yes, Your Honor. It was my understanding that that did occur.
So what then is the answer to Justice Berger's question? Given all that, what difference does it make that at the time Muhammad was, Reinhold or whatever his last name is, was in the hospital and intubated, that the police officer didn't indicate that to the jury or wasn't cross-examined on that?
I understand that the there are reasons for questioning Renfrew's credibility, which I can articulate to the court at this time. But
what do they have to do with whether he could have orally conveyed to the police officer while he was in the hospital Jones's name as a participant in the incident, given all the other evidence that was produced at trial that Jones was a participant in the incident?
I'm sorry, if you could restate that, Your Honor.
I'll try. Given all the evidence produced at trial that Jones was a participant in the incident,
yes,
about as benignly as I can characterize his role, what difference does it make that there was some arguable issue about whether he could have articulated Jones's name to the police officer when the police officer talked to Muhammad Reinfall in the hospital?
Your Honor, Jones' perspective on the entire prosecution is that the whole prosecution was essentially a sort of a fraud against him, and that the police and Renfrew and others, prosecutors, et cetera, cooperated in a conspiracy to falsely accuse him, and that it began at the in the hospital bed of Mr. Renfrew on the day this event happened. So I can't offer the court any particular proof of that as I stand here at the moment, but perhaps it would have enabled that broad attack on the whole, so to speak, fraud that Mr. Jones felt he was facing if he had been able to show that at the outset.
The world is all against me. It's a conspiracy against me. They all made it up. Defense.
That's the central perspective of the defendant. Yes, okay. Your Honor. If I might move on, Your Honor, to the speedy trial. Again, that is supported by the record and procedural record. In that, as Your Honors have seen in my opening brief, as I highlighted from the docket, Jones repeatedly asked for his trial to be moved along and asked for new counsel, and there were delays that were not the prosecution's fault nor the court's fault, given that there was a stay at one point of capital cases regarding those sentences. And there's also a motion that was filed on his behalf by his later counsel to the effect that his juvenile status warranted some special concern by the court. But in between those things, Your Honor, those sort of big gaps of time, he repeatedly asked for new counsel, and court repeatedly denied those things. And he highlighted to the court that his public defenders who were assigned to him, he felt were compromised by personal relationships that preexisted the events that are alleged in the case. And he had an uncooperative relationship for months, or if not years, with that counsel. Finally, on 2 weeks before trial, in November of 2003, counsel themselves approached the court, public defender counsel that he had, and say, "It has gotten to be totally unworkable, Your Honor, and we asked to withdraw from the case." And at that point, court below continued the case, or excuse me, excused counsel on their motion and postponed the November 24, 2003 trial.
You would agree that the law is that the defendant who can't afford their own counsel has a right to counsel, but not a right to select counsel.
Understood, Your Honor.
Correct?
That was clear to Mr. Jones.
To the extent this is folded into a speedy trial argument, can you put the speedy trial argument into Barker versus Wingo terms so we know how to analyze this difficulty with counsel in light of how we're supposed to analyze the overall speedy trial issue?
Yes, Your Honor. As Your Honor points out, Barker is the controlling authority on speedy trial analysis. There's four factors in Barker. And we would submit that the Superior Court got Barker application wrong in its opinion, post-conviction opinion in this case. That is, number one, it's no question that Jones repeatedly asserted that right. So to some extent, the court, as I quoted, found that Jones did not assert this right, and I would submit that his court found that this factor weighs against Jones, but I would submit that, in fact, he did nothing if not use that refrain about speedy trial repeatedly below. So the court's weighing of that factor, I would submit, was inaccurate. Prejudice to the defendant, Your Honor, the fourth and last factor is the one that I would submit gives the whole analysis some bite, and that is that Desiree Harper was a witness that Mr. Jones says identified as an alibi witness. Now, this witness was not used by his trial counsel in this case.
Has this witness ever been found?
Not that I know of, Your Honor. Not that I know of.
And I believe the trial court suggested that this person doesn't actually exist.
That was.
Now, that may be a fairly extreme position to take, but don't you have a burden if you're going to claim that there is some prejudice because some potentially favorable witness has disappeared, at least to demonstrate that this person once was around? And is there anything in this record other than an attempt to send a subpoena that never got to anywhere?
Your Honor, the record does not reflect anything substantive, as Your Honor points out. Desiree Harper was served for a prior trial date, was not served for the later trial date. The subpoena was turned non-est as to her for the later trial date. And that's part of why, Your Honor, I would submit that the court should have allowed the record to be expanded below and allowed a hearing so that Jones, with counsel, could have used efforts to identify and locate Desiree Harper post-trial during the post-conviction, during the pendency of the post-conviction motion. Namely, there is no record, but with an allowance for an expanded record below and counsel to explore and investigate that below, Your Honor, that the Desiree Harper
and her
substance could have been developed, Your Honor.
Counsel was free to develop that on its own, weren't you?
In this court, Your Honor?
Well, when the post-conviction motion was filed?
Yes, Your Honor. I was not at Mr. Jones' side.
Okay, so when you were preparing for this appeal?
Yes, Your Honor.
You could have looked around to see what there was?
That's true. I did not do that, Your Honor, and I guess I could have sought access to an investigator to try to do that, but I did not do that.
I mean, obviously, we're not taking evidence in the Supreme Court, but at the same time, you're asking the court to instruct the trial court to conduct an evidentiary hearing, and presumably nobody, including counsel, would want to go through that process just on a lark. So you would want to say, okay, what is there out there that justifies looking into the matter further? And am I correct that we really don't have anything?
You do not have anything, Your Honor. Okay. And I've spoken to Mr. Jones, and I guess I can't talk about confidences, but I know nothing. I did not have an address or any particular hook to go pursue beyond the name. I have not pursued that, Your Honor. So there's nothing in the record beyond the name on the docket.
And no offer of proof as to what she would testify to had she been brought into the case.
Beyond the word alibi witness, beyond that phrasing, Your Honor, I have no particular offer to make to the court from Mr. Jones nor through me, Your Honor.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
May I, Your Honor? Your Honor, I know I am in the yellow there, and if there's no further questions, I'll sit down at this time. Thank you, Your Honor.
If it pleases the court, the issue, of course, is at this stage of the proceedings whether Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Capone were constitutionally ineffective for not raising certain issues. The trial judge here, in receiving the motion for post-conviction relief alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, first followed the preferred practice in asking trial counsel to submit their affidavits, which was done. Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Capone answered each of the allegations and explain why they took actions or did not take actions. Mr. O'Connell pointed out, as far as the challenge to the arrest warrant goes, well, by the time Mr. Jones was indicted in September 01, the indictment in September 01 rendered the arrest warrant a nullity, and he was not arrested then until September, I believe, of that year. So he was arrested on the strength of the indictment and the Rule 9 warrant issued by a superior court and not on the indictment. And as Mr. O'Connell also pointed out, no evidence flowed from his arrest. He made no statements. The police found no incriminating evidence. So there was certainly no fruit of any poisonous tree. The tree was a nullity by the time of his arrest, and there were no fruits anyway. So there was no point in challenging the arrest warrant. And I should also point out that this is all based on a notation in a medical record that he was intubated when he was in the hospital. And I simply point out there are different kinds of intubation. The kind that the paramedics do on the scene is called endotracheal. That's down your throat through your voice box. No, you cannot talk. But in the hospital, they do other types of intubation, which can talk now. But whether we need a hearing to see what kind of intubation at the time the police officer talked to him, there doesn't seem to be any reason because, as Mr. O'Connell pointed out, nothing flowed from the arrest warrant, and it was a nullity by the time Mr. Jones was arrested.
Wasn't Detective Cunningham a pretty significant figure at the trial? And if he could have been impeached that, you basically put something in an affidavit that couldn't have happened, wouldn't that have torn a bit of a hole in the state's case?
Well, I don't know if it would have torn a hole in the state's case. I mean, Mr. Reinford's statement to the police is consistent with his trial testimony. I see absolutely no reason why. I don't see how Detective Cunningham would come up with this, without having got this information from Mr. Reinford. That he was the source of the information. He was the only source of the information. Otherwise, I'd have to say that Detective Cunningham was somehow prescient or had a sixth sense or something. He could make this stuff up, and then the stuff could actually turn out to be true. I'm just saying that this seems to be a tempest in a teapot, and that Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Capone and or his previous counsel, Mr. Cross and Mr. Radowski, cannot be faulted as constitutionally ineffective for failing to follow this up. It seems to me it would have led nowhere. They certainly had better ways to spend their time. The other issue that's raised is that speedy trial issue. It's certainly at first glance. As we know from Barker v. Wingo and the teachings of this court following Barker v. Wingo, the speedy trial clock starts to run at arrest or indictment, whichever comes first. The crime here was in November of 1999. Both Mr. Jones and Darryl Page, the co-defendants, absconded. Mr. Page was arrested a year later, I think in November of 2000. At that time, the state indicted both of them in January of 2001. That started the speedy trial clock ticking for Mr. Jones, even though he had not yet been apprehended. He was finally apprehended then in the end of September of that year, 2001, returned to Delaware at the end of October. At that point, he was appointed counsel, Mr. Cross and Mr. Radowski of the Public Defender's Office. Trial was then assigned to Judge Abelman, who then I think in November, scheduled trial for a year hence.
Let me make sure I haven't missed something. What was the date that Mr. Jones was incarcerated on these charges?
He was arrested in Georgia at, I think, September 30th of 01. Presumably he was incarcerated in Georgia, and then he arrived in Delaware, I think, according to the docket, I think it was October 30th. It may have been October 29th of that year, about 2 months later.
Okay.
From thence forward, he was incarcerated. The first trial date was November of, that would have been November of 02, and in September, a stay was issued occasioned by Ring versus Arizona, and that stay passed through the November trial date, and was issued in September of 2002 and was lifted in January 2003. Now, at this point, the docket indicates that the trial date was scheduled for the following November, but the trial judge, in her order denying post-conviction relief, states that the trial at that point, when the stay was lifted in January, was scheduled for May 29th, but that date was continued at the state's request to November because the co-prosecutor had left the office to have a baby and said maternity leave, but she was it was Valerie Farnan, and she was replaced by John Barber. But anyway, that seems to be the definite state's continuance from May 29th to November 24th.
Having one of two prosecutors leave the office temporarily for whatever reason, is it customary that that would cause a trial to be continued?
At that point, we had to bring in a new prosecutor, and one was assigned, Mr. Barber. But apparently this happens close enough to the May trial date that we asked for a continuance. So there is a 6 month delay there occasioned by the state's asking for a continuance on account of one of the prosecutors left the office.
Yeah, well, my question is, in your experience, is that sort of de rigueur? A prosecutor leaves, the prosecutor is only one of two, and it causes someone to stay in jail 6 months longer awaiting trial?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't happen that often. But in a serious case like this, this was a capital case initially. We do like to have two prosecutors assigned, and we like to have both prosecutors prepared and knowledgeable about the case. And I don't know when Mrs. Farnan actually left the office and how unexpected it was. I believe, if I recall correctly, she was premature. But the
suggestion is that whenever people had noticed that that might happen, the state asked for a continuance, and the implication is that it takes 6 months to assign the additional prosecutor and for that prosecutor to come up to speed in the case?
Now, why it was actually from May, why the trial judge chose May or November, I'm not sure. That may have been simply, you know, trying to find a place to put it in after the original continuance. All I'm saying, I don't think the state asked for 6 months. There's absolutely no reason for that. I'm not suggesting that. I'm simply saying that this delay, for whatever reason it was scheduled for November 24th, should be charged against the state because if the state's the one who asked that the May date be continued.
That I understand. Thank you.
Now, if it had been continued for 2 months or something then, but that would have been fine. No, we did not ask for 6 months to bring a new prosecutor up.
Okay, there could be many other reasons why.
That's my fault. I gave that impression. Okay. And then in November, of course, there was the now, all along, Mr. Jones had been complaining about one of his assistant public defenders, Mr. Cross. He got it into his head somehow that Mr. Cross was good friends with the family of one of the victims, Monika Plant, whose father was a prominent Delaware politician, Al O. Plant. And Mr. Cross denied that. Mr. Jones said that, Mr. Cross had told him that he was good friends with the Plant family. Mr. Cross denied that. But he somehow got it into his head that Mr. Cross was a good friend of the Plant family. But this had been going on for some time. Mr. Jones had also been filing pro se motions for a speedy trial. If I could just jump ahead to defendant's assertion of his right, this court made clear in Middlebrook v. State that the pro se complaints of speedy trial do count. So this factor weighs in Mr. Jones' favor. He did complain loudly and often about his speedy trial rights. At the same time, he did not cooperate with his attorneys. But the straw that broke the camel's back as far as replacing Mr. Cross and Mr. Radulski came about by a video conference about a month before trial, the November 03 trial date, another public defender walked into the video conference, looked at the video monitor and said something to the effect, is that the murderer? This was overheard by Mr. Jones, who said to himself, oh, my heavens, they're calling me a murderer. And so once again, he demanded that new counsel be appointed, and this time the trial judge said, look, you know, at this stage, you know, I'm going to have to, and Mr. Cross, once again, this is and the hearing here is in the appellant's appendix, begins in A-153 forward. Mr. Cross said, and in addition to that, Mr. Jones is simply not cooperating. We're trying to put together a mitigation case, and he is not cooperating at all, saying he's not, I don't need to because I'm innocent. We're never going to get that far. So for a variety of reasons, the trial judge finally did say, all right, we will appoint new counsel. At that point, Mr. Capone and Mr. O'Connell, two very experienced attorneys. At that time, Mr. O'Connell was not with the public defender's office. He was a conflict attorney. Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Capone then were appointed. Trial was scheduled now for August of, this would have been 04, the following year, to give Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Capone a chance to come up to speed. And then in June, the United States Supreme Court once again accepted certiorari in a case dealing in Roper v. Simmons, a case dealing with whether or not the death penalty may be imposed on 16 and 17-year-olds. Mr. Jones was a few months shy of his 18th birthday at the time of the murders. Therefore, he fell into this. Now, the judge was not going to immediately preclude the state. And the judge in the ruling said, look, this is Delaware Superior Court. I'm not going to the United States Supreme Court hasn't spoken. Our statute says we can do it. But there were motions filed, and there was a hearing, and this went through the August trial date before the judge finally denied the motion. And then trial was scheduled once again for the fourth time, January 05, when it went forward. Now, the issue is, were Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Capone looking at this on direct appeal, were they constitutionally ineffective for not raising the speedy trial issue on direct appeal? And Mr. O'Connell, in his affidavit, said, look, I got as far as drafting an argument. I did the research. I got as far as drafting an argument, and I looked at it, and I said, no, I'm not going to file it. I have these other issues that I think are better. I'm going to put that one aside. And I believe seven issues were raised, and including a very, very touchy Batson issue, which was the main event, if I recall correctly. And this is the kind of decisions, strategic decisions, that we expect our attorneys to make. Mr. O'Connell certainly, this didn't pass him by. He was aware that there was a genuine speedy trial issue here. As far as the other issues, I think Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Capone both addressed them. As far as this Desiree Harper or other witnesses, neither recalled a Desiree Harper being mentioned. Mr. O'Connell made a very good point, however. He did interview Tina Williams that was suggested by Mr. Jones as a possible alibi witness who does exist, and I mean he did talk to her, and she found her not to be very credible. But the problem he had with an alibi witness, and he makes a very good point here, is that the offense was in November of 99. Mr. Jones was on the lam until almost 2 years later, September of 01. So if you even got in there right away to interview an alibi witness, almost 2 years have passed since this alibi witness from 2 years ago is now, having no knowledge that she is going to be an alibi witness, is suddenly going to be asked to remember
where she was on a date specific 2 years prior. And I think as Mr. O'Connell points out, you know, that's a lot for a jury to swallow, you know, unless there's some really good reason to remember that date. But he found her, Ms. Williams, to be not a very credible witness. Mr. Bone said he remembered interviewing somebody and finding that person not to be very credible. But he couldn't remember what the name was. But, see, my warning light is on. If the issue is, as my friend said, that there should have been a hearing, I don't see what the hearing would have accomplished. The affidavits filed by counsel here were quite complete, and the record was complete, and the judge, of course, wrote quite a bit and addressed each and every issue that was raised, and I asked the court to find no abuse of discretion in the manner in which this this matter was handled. Thank you.
You know, as I recognize that there are six issues that were listed in the opening brief and were responded to, if I could focus the court on less abstract things of this appeal, it should give the court pause. The concrete things that Mr. Jones raises are deal with, one, the handling of Muhammad Renford, the identifying witness, the victim of a shooting in the hospital, namely that he was intubated at the time that he allegedly was spoken to by Detective Cunningham on the 21st, that there were hospital personnel obviously attending to him throughout that time period. And Jones' perspective is that that was not adequately investigated and attacked by his trial counsel. And I would submit that it does raise ineffective assistance questions on investigation basis for that by his own counsel, and to the cross-examination and attack of that evidence at trial from his counsel. So,
well, if Mr. Renford had died and it was presented as a dying declaration and was the only evidence in the case that Mr. Jones was involved in the incident, you might have a point. But didn't we go over what the other evidence was at trial of Mr. Jones' participation? And doesn't the issue of whether he actually could have said what he said to the police officer at the time because he was intubated become moot? Or at least not very substantive.
Your Honor, I think logically, or that I understand the appeal of that, Your Honor. But again, from Jones's perspective.
Well, I understand Mr. Jones is a conspiracy theorist, and I understand his perspective wholly. But what we're focused here is, what is the law of this case? How do we rule on these legal issues, regardless of Mr. Jones's perspective on what they mean to him?
And to that point, Your Honor, does counsel, for example, Mr. O'Connell's affidavit, the effect that, well, Jones just said this the next day, perhaps, and it's my opinion that is how he phrased it in his affidavit, which the Superior Court relied upon, doesn't that raise a credibility question, I would submit, that in a proper exercise of its discretion, the Superior Court should have held a hearing on to weigh whether O'Connell's affidavit, the effect that he didn't raise the speedy trial violation on appeal because he thought it'd be one thing too many to raise, essentially. And is that credible? Is that persuasive when this court is very adept at handling multiple issues at once? It has no shortage of attention, this court, and counsel's essentially bagging that issue and really not getting any kind of hearing on that until now, along with the point, well, it's my opinion that Mr. Renford could have said this the next day. Do those things put Mr. O'Connell's credibility on the line that would have should have allowed Jones counsel to question that and to explore that before the court below relied upon those things, Your Honor?
Well, when you talk about his credibility, do you mean you would attack whether he was truthful in his affidavit, or you would attack whether, given his affidavit, his conclusion was the exercise of good judgment or not?
Yes, Your Honor, the latter.
Then why is it necessary to have a hearing to discern his credibility?
Well, his professional judgment, Your Honor, shaped that affidavit, I would submit, about choices that were made. And it informed the court's opinion. And so whether it's credibility or whether the court should have, below, should have simply adopted that offer of Mr. O'Connell without some testing, Your Honor, on cross-examination, with whatever evidence that Jones might be able to offer below about other hospital personnel, perhaps, who were there, or Cunningham, Your Honor, I would submit that it was an abuse of discretion not to allow those things to be explored in a motion hearing. And the hooks in the case, again, Your Honor, are the Desiree Harper. Likewise, counsel have rebuffed her as being somebody they don't really know anything about. How do we know she's a real person? That those concrete hooks in the matter, Desiree Harper and or the hospital personnel, Detective Cunningham, their identification or corroboration of an identification at the hospital are adequate questions that would warrant discretion to allow a hearing. That's all I had, Your Honor, unless there's more questions, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Take the case under advisement and recess.